Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. I'm very happy to have as my guest today on Research Matters, Professor Godfrey Baldacchino. Just a few words about him. Professor Baldacchino is a Canada Research Chair in Island Studies at the University of Prince Edward Island in Canada, Visiting Professor of Sociology here at the University of Malta. He's Executive Editor of Island Studies Journal, and he has published, of course, very widely, and his latest work includes A World of Islands in 2007 and also Bridging Islands, The Impact of Fixed Links, also 2007, and his recent articles have appeared in Asia Pacific Viewpoint, Canadian Geographer, Journal of Small Business and Entrepreneurship, and World Development. Welcome, Professor Baldacchino.
Thank you, Tricia.
Before we speak about your latest research project, perhaps we should give an outline of what your research speciality really involves. In short, what are island studies? What is the purpose of them in a general sense?
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting question. And of course, coming as I do from Malta, the answer is almost trite. Because to us who are in Malta, many of us at least, we take pride in the fact that we are an island state, and that logically, much of what we do and much of what we can learn from can be compared or contrasted with other island jurisdictions comparable to ours. So the island studies approach is really privileging islandness and insularity, and whatever that may mean, in relation to the subject under discussion. Of course, it's highly interdisciplinary, it's highly focused and highly applied, but at the same time, it's highly refreshing, and I would also say extremely powerful, because it provides tools for policy analysis, for methodology, and for the pursuit of knowledge and research that tends to be rather fresh and different from the mainstream. Because unfortunately, even though it seems obvious, islands don't usually look at other islands for insights.
In fact, I was thinking we sort of think of ourselves always and refer to ourselves as a microcosm of a larger country, perhaps avoiding the issue of looking at our islandness because
Indeed.
We want to feel as though we're part of the mainstream country
picture. Of course, Malta is obviously a member of the family of sovereign states, but in privileging and enhancing the notion of state, we sometimes forget that we're also an island state.
And that does make a difference at various levels, at probably at just about every level.
Yes, exactly. Much of the research that I'm actually doing has to do with lots of areas that are of immediate interest to Malta. For example, migration, tourism, higher education, governance issues. So when you start looking at all these subjects from the vantage point of an island studies perspective, you suddenly appreciate and start realizing that things may be a bit different than what they initially seem.
And in fact, even from the sea, recently I was discussing maritime issues with Professor Carmen Vassallo.
Right.
And he was commenting on how we have to really look at the sea because it's so much part of an integral part of our existence.
Exactly. I mean, again, one of the biases of having a state-driven analysis of your reality is that state analysis tends to be land-based. It has a land bias. Whereas island states are, of course, surrounded by the sea, and the sea has been historically their destiny. A ship appears on the horizon and your island history changes overnight, as we know all too well.
Absolutely. In fact, that was what was interesting, talking to him about the fact that the sea has an interesting history that has changed our existence, really, over the years, but then is part of the economy.
Of course. I mean, Malta and other island jurisdictions, we are obliged to be open and vulnerable to the traffic, the cargo coming in from elsewhere, whether it's exports, whether it's imports, whether it's tourism, whether it's hurricanes coming from across the horizon. You know, the invasive characteristic of an island state is something that we have to live with. And we, of course, historically and culturally, we develop resilience, we develop skills and tools in order to handle as best we can this uncontrollable element in our lives.
I remember being taken to see the Bronze Age silos at Brzezowa with Dr. David Trump many years ago, and he was standing near them, and he said, well, if you look at these, and then you look at what's behind me, which was the Freeport, of course, he told me, more or less, we're talking about the same thing.
Exactly.
Here.
Things haven't really changed over 2,000 years.
Well, turning to the case for non-sovereignty, which this is a publication which you've edited together with Professor David Milne, who I gather is an expert in federalism and also emeritus professor of political studies at your present
university. And living in Malta, by the way.
Really?
Indeed. We've basically swapped places.
That's interesting. The general theme is SNIJ, is a lovely acronym for Subnational Island Jurisdictions. Perhaps you could start off by explaining what that means.
Of course. We call them SNIJs in short. A subnational jurisdiction is an autonomous territory, which, however, has not achieved sovereignty. So in the Maltese context, for example, we can perhaps think of Gozo. It is not a state, of course, it is not a sovereign country, but it has some degree of autonomy. I mean, we know very well that Gozo has its own minister responsible for Gozo affairs, and that minister has a privileged position in cabinet where Gozo affairs are concerned. So Gozo represents a whole family of islands that are struck in between, if you wish, municipal status and sovereign status. Gozo is neither one nor the other, as we know. And this in-betweenity creates both opportunities and threats. It depends how you look at it. And the book that you very kindly offered to discuss today, Richard, is a global review of the way in which many of these island jurisdictions negotiate their way with usually one powerful mainland state, metropolitan country, which has a direct interest in that jurisdiction.
And I was looking at the list of these SNIJs that you were discussing, American Samoa, Aruba, the British Virgin Islands, Cook Islands, the Faroes. We're talking about very different places
Indeed,
here.
Indeed, they are much more diverse and different than small island states, because, just to give an example, all small island states except one are in the temperate or tropical zone. The only exception is Iceland. Otherwise, they're all basically, you know, close together in certain parts of the world, especially the Pacific and the Caribbean. They tend to excel in tourism and so on. Whereas these SNIJs, these subnational jurisdictions, are located in all the longitudes and latitudes of the world. They come with different ecologies, different political systems, different former or current colonial masters, and different powers as well. So their autonomy can manifest itself in different ways. One particular autonomy can have jurisdiction on, say, culture and language issues. The Åland Islands in the Baltic Sea are very proud Swedish-speaking community, even though they're part of Finland. Finland is their metropolitan state. But other countries have gone in other directions, say, Bermuda, which is now the largest British overseas territory, for example, has excelled as an offshore finance center with a very specialized banking and finance industry. So there are enormous differences, and of course part of the challenge of island studies is to look at patterns with all these differences. And the dominating pattern of this particular publication, which is part of an ongoing project, is the way that the 21st century creates opportunities perhaps with tweaking this whole notion of sovereignty in such a way that many of these subnational units are no longer actively looking for becoming independent. And that might come as a shock to some of our listeners. You know. Especially we Maltese have been very proud about acquiring our independence, and of course we seem to have done a very good job of it over the past 40, 50 years. But things have changed in the world, and the latest experience of Iceland in relation to the financial crisis, for example, has alerted us once again that sovereignty can be very fragile. That, of course, in the case of Malta, we are also part of a larger union, the European Union. Iceland does not have the benefit of that. But even without that kind of argument, it has become fairly clear that countries that are not completely sovereign, and therefore can still rely on other larger, typically larger states, to bail them out if the need arises. It's a winnable and shrewd diplomatic strategy.
This project, the jurisdiction project, it was something you embarked on as a general research project. Were there other people involved with it?
Well, yes. Of course, the basis of the project is the Island Studies Program at the University of Prince Edward Island. Prince Edward Island is the smallest province in Canada, just 140,000 people, but it has its own university, and it has realized straight away that one of its core competences in the world is the study of islands. We also have a master's in islands and island studies at the University of Prince Edward Island, just like the University of Malta. So we have tried as much as possible to develop this expertise. We have deployed our graduate students into research assistants who have been assiduously compiling information about all these SNGs from around the world. And we now have a database that's actually online and searchable via a fairly smooth and user-friendly technique, where you can compare two islands together, develop, say, an interest in, I don't know, the migration policies of Tristan da Cunha, and see, you know, how Tristan da Cunha manages its migration flows. You can do that now very, very seamlessly from a website. And the link to that website is through the website that I moderate. It's very easy. It's islandstudies.ca.
Tristan da Cunha, gosh, cast me back to my childhood. I think they had
a volcanic eruption,
if I remember rightly. And I must have been a small girl.
Straight back to the point I was trying to make. Imagine if Tristan da Cunha was an independent country, and suddenly it has a volcanic eruption, and everybody has to be evacuated. Who's going to take them? Under what conditions? It's problematic, right? Mm. Luckily for the Tristans, Tristan da Cunha is a UK overseas territory. So the UK government was obliged, even under international law, to take them, to evacuate them, keep them in the UK until the danger subsided, and then, of course, take them back. Montserrat has the same experience in 1995. Soufrière, the main volcano on Montserrat, erupted, making two-thirds of the island uninhabitable. The capital city was submerged by lava. I mean, it was a very serious eruption, and all 10,000 inhabitants were taken to England and stayed there for various years before some of them went back.
In fact, there was a lot of discussion about whether they should go back at all.
They are now back, and the place is thriving, mainly as a finance centre as well.
So the project itself is financed probably by the university and...
No. This project, I actually applied for funding from the main Canadian National Granting Agency for the Social Sciences. It's called the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. In short, it's called SHRC. So SHRC is the main funding body, and there's a competitive process. So, I applied along with so many others, and I was successful, so I got... around $200,000 for 3 years to kickstart this project. And when the first 3 years expired, I reapplied and I got a further $42,000 for the following 3 years. So it's an ongoing project. The first financing went to the actual creation of the website and the research support that allowed the data to be compiled and uploaded. More recently, we are trying to share now the information that we have to a wider audience. And I know that you were planning also to ask me about dissemination. And dissemination isn't just through books and publications. David Milne and I, we've co-edited a special issue of the world's oldest international relations journal, which is called The Roundtable, celebrating actually 100 years this year. But over and above that, we're also in good contact with various colleagues in the scholarly sphere, but also in the policy sphere. Of course, I mean, much of what we say has an enormous relevance to policymakers on the ground in many of these SNGs. And hopefully over the next couple of years, I will be involved in the organization of at least 4 conferences in different parts of the world with different stakeholders, much of which would be showcasing the results of the study.
In fact, this is a prime example of where networking is an absolute must.
Indeed, of course. And this is a very particular network because it brings together academics and policymakers, some of whom are one and the same, from, again, this is a characteristic of small societies, from universities in small jurisdictions, but also interested in small jurisdictions from other parts of the world, including the US, the UK, Australia, and other larger players. As well as many of these, some of them are wannabe sovereign states, but some of them are absolutely very, very happy with their current status. But of course, always very keen and nervous about how that status can change. Just to give you another example, Guernsey and Jersey, the Channel Islands, two of the world's oldest subnational jurisdictions. They have been autonomous for 800 years, since 1204. Thanks to a quirk of history.
I suppose they're very keen on probably want to remain as they are. I would imagine they've done very well.
You see, the problem is this, that they are under the purview of the British Crown. And when Britain starts making noises about streamlining its offshore finance centers, all right, they start getting goosebumps. And they know that they have a wild card up their sleeve. The wild card is independence. And they may want to cash that, or they may want to send threats that they may cash that. And so far, that has basically worked. There's always such a keen debate in Jersey, in Guernsey, as to whether they should proceed towards further autonomy, possibly even go the whole way to complete independence, in order to be able to regulate more comprehensively their offshore finance regime, which is, of course, their bread and butter.
Yeah, sort of balance, counterbalance of the arguments, the case sort of keeping the thing afloat.
Indeed. Many small jurisdictions, one of the advantages of small size in their case is that by lowering the tax rate, you actually have more tax in your pocket. It seems contradictory, but it works. Because when you lower your tax rate, you widen the tax base. There are more people suddenly interested in what you are offering, and therefore you accrue more taxpayers, even though each is paying less. I know it's a zero-sum game. I mean, it's a race to the bottom. We have to be very careful because there is a tax justice network, which is very active, which is arguing very much in the sense that the welfare state is under threat if tax rates are on a race to the bottom.
I did dip into your particular contribution to the book. I unfortunately wasn't able to read it from cover to cover, but it certainly immediately caught my interest because I'm afraid I had absolutely no idea about this particular place that you're talking about, and which is Kish. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of your contribution, you say you describe the situation of Kish, and then you say readers will probably think that I'm sort of inventing this because it sounds so unlikely. And I'm afraid I thought you were pulling my leg actually. Yeah. So do tell us about Kish.
Of course. Well, for the benefit of the readers, first of all, Kish, K-I-S-H, it's a very small island located about 18 miles south of mainland Iran. This is I-R-A-N, all right? And of course, what comes to mind straight away in the case of Iran is a fundamentalist, theocratic regime with serious clampdowns on freedom of expression, freedom of how to dress, what to do, what to wear, etc., right? Well, Kish is a safe spot. It's like an enclave within the Iranian state, deliberately set up by the Iranian state. I mean, some of these subnational jurisdictions don't just happen, don't just emerge out of the blue. Some of them are actually engineered. And Kish is one of these engineered zones whereby both Iranians and Westerners and foreigners are encouraged to meet in an environment that is less threatening and much more liberal, much more Westernized. And of course, the reason being that Iran cannot survive unless it maintains some links with the rest of the world. Whether to purchase military equipment on the black market or to have consultants engaged in providing advice on technological developments. Iran needs the links with the rest of the world. So how do you do that without threatening your fundamentalist principles? Well, you do that by offshoring. This is a very important word. You offshore that a particular space in your country, and islands are ideal for that because you can literally, you know, offshore in a bounded space. The island becomes a safe and controllable zone, very small, where whatever needs to be done is done without any threat to the mainland way of things.
How big is Kish, actually, square kilometers?
I think it's slightly larger than Gozo in terms of square kilometers. Mm. Yeah, I think it's 5 kilometers wide and 18 kilometers long, something like that. Mm,
small, but not tiny.
No. Mm-hmm. Large enough.
Mm. This idea of having one country,
two systems,
yeah. the Hong Kong idea, is this something like
Again,
that?
You see, you are already realizing the comparisons between islands that have nothing to do with each other. But yes, indeed, yes, we're talking about one country, but multiple systems, not necessarily two. In the case of the United Kingdom, it's one country, 15 systems. Because the United Kingdom still has 15 overseas territories that it is responsible for.
As many as that still?
Indeed. And 14 out of those 15 are islands. Which one is not an island?
The Pacific, I suppose there's something left in the Pacific.
Yes, but it's an island.
Yes, all the islands, yes, absolutely.
The only one that's not an island is Gibraltar. Which is perhaps more islandish than
exactly.
One would think.
It's almost, you have to look on the map to realize that it's not actually, because exactly. One gets the idea that it is. And Macau, perhaps.
Yes, Macau and Hong Kong are both now officially special administrative regions of the People's Republic of China. And of course, the reason for that is they have been the longest colonies on that part of the world. One, Macau being Portuguese, the other Hong Kong being British. But in negotiating their eventual secession back to mainland China, which was the basis of their treaty of annexation in the first place, both the Portuguese and the Brits, but also the Chinese, they were very, very shrewd in crafting those spaces as special regions, because they know very well that some things happening in Hong Kong are not possible, or possible only under extreme circumstances in mainland China. Just to give you an idea, Hong Kong is a free port. Hong Kong is an offshore finance center. Hong Kong is a crossroads of cultures, of expertise, of knowledge, of capital. And those people who are wary and apprehensive about what's happening in mainland China will be much more comfortable working in Hong Kong. And that is exactly what has happened.
It's a big compromise, though, for certain Chinese government. It always struck me that it must be very difficult for them to swallow somehow.
Yes, and we have evidence of this regularly in the press. I mean, the administrative organ of China is still very much dominated by appointees from the mainland, to the chagrin of the Hong Kongese. But that may also change, because there's a groundswell of democratic activity in Hong Kong, and possibly the number of elected officials, locally elected officials on this board may change with time. So it is a trial and error. It's an experiment, and both sides are very wary, you know, not to muddy the waters, to maintain a positive relationship, and in the context of that positive relationship, to try to explore ways in which to enhance political and economic development, which is beneficial to both sides.
Because it sort of democracy rears its head. Discussions about democracy tend to rear their heads in an economic climate that is more akin to democratic states than
yes. Liberal economics ones. May tend to move parallel with liberal politics, although that's not always the case.
No, that's true. We were talking about dissemination before. One looks at a project like yours, which is clearly of great interest to many, many different countries, as we've discovered, very different types of countries. Mm-hmm. It is so important that what the results you've come up with, and after all, the book discusses, I think there are about more than 10 contributors overall from USA, from
yes.
UK, from Canada.
Yes.
Getting your message across. Because, I mean, this book can sit in the Militencia here at the University of Malta or in
yes.
any of the other universities, and it's not really going to do much good. How are you going to really get those ideas across to an interested academic audience, but also to the policy makers?
That's a very good question, Tricia. And in a way, it is the dilemma of all academics, right? We spend so much time doing all this, and we spend so much money as well. And suddenly we have the book, and unfortunately for some of us, the book is the end rather than the beginning. Well, in this case, what I'm pleased to say is that, first of all, it's an edited collection, and this is a strategic choice, because when you have contributors to a volume like this, each and every contributor has a stake in not just the compilation of the book, but also in what it represents. So we already have a number of roving ambassadors, if you wish, who are taking the debate forward and pushing ahead with speaking to whoever they need to speak to in order to put the message across. Over and above that, I also mentioned the various conferences that I spoke to you about. But there are various also island studies-related networks where both people interested in policy but also academics are involved. And it's a very healthy, synergetic combination and bringing together of minds and ideas. The Global Islands Network, for example, a very important clearinghouse of information, www.globalislands.net. There's the International Island Studies Association, of which I am a member of the executive, with biennial conferences attracting usually 200 to 300 people. There's now an islands commission within the International Geographical Union, one of the most prestigious geographical associations in the world, which again is having a conference which I'm co-organizing in Sweden next year. there are also think tanks, policy think tanks, in some of these islands. I mean, we mentioned the Åland Islands earlier. The Åland Islands, for its 25,000 inhabitants, has a comparative center of island studies that's totally funded by the private sector. It's unbelievable. The insurance and cruise ship companies, which are very big in the Iceland, the Icelandic economy, they have put their heads together and decided that, yes, comparative island studies approach makes sense for them. There's so much to learn. And I am privileged to be the chair of their academic advisory board. So we are all the time engaging in policymakers. One of the advantages of small economies is that policymakers are not that far removed.
That's it. As you said, sometimes you have the same person wearing two hats.
Indeed.
And also because there is this advantage, which sometimes seems rather a disadvantage, but in this case is probably an advantage, that one is closer to the coalface of government.
Exactly.
Than in another situation, in
exactly.
A larger country.
The Commonwealth is also very interested, Tricia. The Commonwealth, which is a pan-national organization of 54 countries, 32 of whom are defined as small states with a population of less than 1.5 million. So there's a natural constituency there. And in fact, one of the events that have led to this book was held during the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting held in Malta in 2005. Last week, I was at the University of Cambridge, a guest at a small states workshop organized by the Commonwealth in association with the Roundtable Journal. So there is considerable interest in this cutting-edge kind of theorization.
Thank you very, very much, Professor.
It's my pleasure to be on your program.
It's very, very nice of you to have taken time out, and sorry that the time has run out, because
no problem.
Lots more to discuss.
That's the best way to end, right?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My guest today was Professor Godfrey Baldacchino. I do hope that you could join us again next week for another edition of Research Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.